30. Saul dreamed the dream he had suffered since the day Rachel had incurred Merlin's sickness. He was walking through a vast structure, where columns the size of redwood trees rose into the gloom, and where crimson light fell in solid shafts from somewhere far above. There came the sound of a giant conflagration, entire worlds burning. Ahead of him glowed two ovals of the deepest red. Saul knew the place. He knew that he would find an altar ahead with Rachel on it, Rachel in her 20s and unconscious. And then would come the voice, demanding. Saul stopped on the low balcony and stared down at the familiar scene. His daughter, the woman he and Sarai had bid farewell to when she left for postgraduate work on distant Hyperion, lay naked on a broad block of stone. Above them all floated the twin red orbs of the shrike's gaze. On the altar lay a long, curved knife made of sharpened bone. The voice came then. "Saul, take your daughter, your only daughter, Rachel, whom you love, and go to the world called Hyperion, and offer her there as a burnt offering at one of the places of which I shall tell you." Saul's arms were shaking with rage and grief. He pulled at his hair and shouted into the darkness, repeating what he had told that voice before. "There will be no more offerings, neither child nor parent. There will be no more sacrifices. The time of obedience and atonement is past. Either help us as a friend or go away." In previous dreams, this had led to the sound of wind and isolation, terrible footsteps receding in the dark. But this time the dream persisted. The altar shimmered and was suddenly empty, except for the bone knife. The twin red orbs still floated high above, fire-filled rubies the size of worlds. "Saul, listen," came the voice, modulated now so it did not boom from far above, but almost whispered in his ear. "The future of humankind depends upon your choice. Can you offer Rachel out of love, if not obedience?" Saul heard the answer in his mind, even as he groped for the words. "There would be no more offerings, not this day, not any day. Humankind had suffered enough for its love of gods, its long search for God." He thought of the many centuries in which his people, the Jews, had negotiated with God, complaining, bickering, decrying the unfairness of things, but always, always returning to obedience at whatever the cost. Generations dying in the ovens of hatred. Future generations scarred by the cold fires of radiation and renewed hate. Not this time. Not ever again.
"Say yes, Daddy."
Saul started at the touch of a hand on his. His daughter, Rachel, stood next to him. Neither infant nor adult, but the 8-year-old he had known twice, aging and growing backward through that age with Merlin's sickness. Rachel, with her light brown hair tied back in a simple braid, short form soft in washed denim play tunic and kid sneakers. Saul took her hand, gripping as tightly as he could without hurting her, feeling the returned grip. This was no illusion. No final cruelty of the shrike. This was his daughter.
"Say yes, Daddy."
Saul had solved Abraham's problem of obedience to a God turned malicious. Obedience could no longer be paramount in relations between humanity and its deity. But when the child chosen as sacrifice asked for obedience to that God's whim, Saul went to one knee next to his daughter and opened his arms. "Rachel." She hugged him with the energy he remembered from countless such hugs, her chin high over his shoulder, her arms fierce in their intensity of love. She whispered in his ear,
"Please, Daddy, we have to say yes."
Saul continued to hug her, feeling her thin arms around him and the warmth of her cheek against his. He was crying silently, feeling the wetness on his cheeks and in his short beard, but unwilling to release her for even the second it would take to wipe the tears away.
"I love you, Daddy,"
whispered Rachel. He rose then, wiped his face with a swipe of the back of his hand, and with Rachel's left hand still firmly in his, began the long descent with her toward the altar below. Saul awoke with a sense of falling, grabbing for the baby. She was asleep on his chest, her fist curled, her thumb in her mouth. But when he started upright, she awoke with the cry and arching reflex of a startled newborn. Saul got to his feet, dropping blankets and cloak around him, clutching Rachel tightly to him. It was daylight, late morning if anything. They had slept while the night died, and sunlight crept into the valley and across the tombs. The Sphinx huddled over them like some predatory beast, powerful forelegs extended on either side of the stairway where they had slept. Rachel wailed, her face contorting with the shock of waking and hunger, and sensed fear in her father. Saul stood in the fierce sunlight and rocked her. He went to the top step of the Sphinx, changed her diaper, heated one of the last nursing packs, offered it to her until the wails turned to soft nursing sounds, burped her, and walked her around until she drifted into light sleep again. It was less than 10 hours until her birthday. Less than 10 hours until sunset and the last few minutes of his daughter's life. Not for the first time, Saul wished that the Time Tomb were a great glass building, symbolizing the cosmos and the deity that ran it. Saul would throw rocks at the structure until not a single pane remained unbroken. He tried to remember the details of his dream, but the warmth and reassurance of it shredded in the harsh light of Hyperion sun. He remembered only Rachel's whispered entreaty. The thought of offering her to the shrike made Saul's stomach ache with horror. "It's all right," he whispered to her as she twitched and sighed toward the treacherous haven of sleep once again. "It's all right, kiddo. The consul's ship will be here soon. The ship will come any minute." The consul's ship did not come by noon. The consul's ship did not come by mid-afternoon. Saul walked the valley floor, calling out for those who had disappeared, singing half-forgotten songs when Rachel awoke, crooning lullabies as she drifted back to sleep. His daughter was so tiny and light. 6 pounds and 3 ounces, 19 inches at birth, he remembered, smiling at the antique units of his antique home of Barnard's world. In late afternoon, he startled awake from his half-doze in the shade of the Sphinx's outflung paw, standing with Rachel waking in his arms as a spacecraft arched across the dome of deep lapis sky. "It's come," he cried, and Rachel stirred and wiggled as if in response. A line of blue fusion flame glowed with that daylight intensity reserved to spacecraft in atmosphere. Saul hopped up and down, filled with the first relief in many days. He shouted and leaped until Rachel wailed and wept in concern. Saul stopped, lifted her high, knowing that she could not yet focus her eyes, but wanting her to see the beauty of the descending ship as it arced above the distant mountain range, dropping toward the high desert. "He did it!" cried Saul. "He's coming! The ship will—" 3 heavy thuds struck the valley almost at once. The first two were the twin sonic booms of the spacecraft's footprint racing ahead of it as it decelerated. The third was the sound of its destruction. Saul stared as the glowing pinpoint at the apex of the long fusion tail suddenly grew as bright as the sun, expanded into a cloud of flame and boiling gases, and then tumbled toward the distant desert in 10,000 burning pieces. He blinked away retinal echoes as Rachel continued crying. "My God," whispered Saul. "My God." There was no denying the complete destruction of the spacecraft. Secondary explosions ripped the air, even from 30 kilometers away, as pieces fell, trailing smoke and flames, toward the desert, the mountains, and the sea of grass beyond. "My God." Saul sat on the warm sand. He was too exhausted to cry, too empty to do anything but rock his child until her crying stopped. 10 minutes later, Saul looked up as 2 more fusion trails burned the sky, these headed south from the zenith. One of these exploded, too distant for sound to reach him. The second one dropped out of sight below the southern cliffs beyond the bridle range.
"Perhaps it was not the consul," whispered Saul. "It could be the Alster invasion. Perhaps the consul's ship still will come for us."
But the ship did not come by late afternoon. It had not come by the time the light of Hyperion's small sun shone on the cliff wall, shadows reaching for Saul on the highest step of the Sphinx. It did not come when the valley fell in shadow. Rachel was born, less than 30 minutes from this second. Saul checked her diaper, found her dry, and fed her from the last nursing pack. As she ate, she looked up at him, with great dark eyes, seemingly searching his face. Saul remembered the first few minutes he had held her, while Sarai rested under warmed blankets. The baby's eyes had burned into him then with these same questions and startlement at finding such a world. The evening wind brought clouds moving in quickly above the valley. Rumbles to the southwest came first as distant thunder, and then with the sick regularity of artillery, most likely nuclear or plasma explosions 500 clicks or more to the south. Saul scanned the sky between lowering clouds and caught glimpses of fiery meteor trails arching overhead. Ballistic missiles or dropships, probably. Death for Hyperion in either case. Saul ignored it. He sang softly to Rachel as she finished nursing. He had walked to the head of the valley, but now he returned slowly to the Sphinx. The tombs were glowing as never before, rippling with the harsh light of neon gases excited by electrons. Overhead, the last shafts from the setting sun changed the low clouds to a ceiling of pastel flames. Less than 3 minutes remained until the final celebration of Rachel's birth. Even if the consul's ship arrived now, Saul knew that he would not have time to board it or get his child into cryogenic sleep. He did not want to. Saul climbed the stairs to the Sphinx slowly, realizing that Rachel had come this way 26 standard years earlier, never guessing the fate that awaited her in that dark crypt. He paused at the top step and took in a breath. The light from the sun was a palpable thing, filling the sky and igniting the wings and upper mass of the Sphinx. The tomb itself seemed to be releasing the light it had stored, like the rocks in Hebron's desert, where Saul had wandered in the wilderness years before, seeking enlightenment and finding only sorrow. The air shimmered with light, and the wind continued to rise, blowing sand across the valley floor and then relenting. Saul went to one knee on the top step, pulling off Rachel's blanket until the child was in only her soft cotton newborn's clothes, swaddling clothes. Rachel wiggled in his hands. Her face was purple and slick, her hands tiny and red with the effort of clenching and unclenching. Saul remembered her exactly like this, as the doctor handed the infant to Saul, as he stared at his newborn daughter, as he was staring now. Then set her on Sarai's stomach so the mother could see. "Ah, God," breathed Saul, and dropped to his other knee, truly kneeling now. The entire valley quivered as if to an earthquake tremor. Saul could vaguely hear the explosions continuing far to the south, but of more immediate concern now was the terrible glow from the Sphinx. Saul's shadow leaped 50 meters behind him down the stairway and across the valley floor as the tomb pulsed and vibrated with light. Out of the corner of his eye, Saul could see the other tombs glowing as brightly, huge Baroque reactors in their final seconds before meltdown. The entrance to the Sphinx pulsed blue, then violet, then a terrible white. Behind the Sphinx, on the wall of the plateau above the Valley of the Time Tombs, an impossible tree shimmered into existence, its huge trunk and sharp steel branches rising into the glowing clouds and above. Saul glanced quickly, saw the 3-meter thorns and the terrible fruit they bore, and then he looked back at the entrance to the Sphinx. Somewhere the wind howled and thunder rumbled. Somewhere vermilion dust blew like curtains of dried blood in the terrible light from the tombs. Somewhere voices cried out and a chorus shrieked. Saul ignored all this. He had eyes only for his daughter's face, and, beyond her, for the shadow that now filled the glowing entrance to the tomb. The shrike emerged. The thing had to bend to allow its 3-meter bulk and steel blades to clear the top of the doorway. It stepped onto the top porch of the Sphinx and moved forward, part creature, part sculpture, walking with the terrible deliberation of nightmare. The dying light above rippled on the thing's carapace, cascaded down across curving breastplate to steel thorns there, shimmering on finger blades and scalpels rising from every point. Saul hugged Rachel to his chest and stared into the multifaceted red furnaces that passed for the shrike's eyes. The sunset faded into the blood-red glow of Saul's recurrent dream. The shrike's head turned slightly, swiveling without friction, rotating 90 degrees right, 90 degrees left, as if the creature were surveying its domain. The shrike took 3 steps forward, stopping less than 2 meters from Saul. The thing's 4 arms twisted and rose, finger blades uncurling. Saul hugged Rachel tightly to him. Her skin was moist, her face bruised and blotched with the exertions of birth. Seconds remained. Her eyes tracked separately, seemed to focus on Saul.
"Say yes, Daddy," Saul remembered the dream. The shrike's head lowered, until the ruby eyes in that terrible hood stared at nothing but Saul and his child. The quicksilver jaws parted slightly, showing layers and levels of steel teeth. 4 hands came forward, metallic palms up, pausing 0.5 meter from Saul's face. "Say yes, Daddy." Saul remembered the dream, remembered his daughter's hug, and realized that in the end, when all else is dust, loyalty to those we love is all we can carry with us to the grave. Faith, true faith, was trusting in that love. Saul lifted his newborn and dying child, seconds old, shrieking now with her first and last breath, and handed her to the shrike. The absence of her slight weight struck Saul with a terrible vertigo. The shrike lifted Rachel, stepped backward, and was enveloped in light. Behind the Sphinx, the tree of thorns ceased shimmering, shifted into phase with now, and came into terrible focus. Saul stepped forward, arms imploring, as the shrike stepped back into the radiance and was gone. Explosions rippled the clouds and slammed Saul to his knees with shock waves of pressure. Behind him, around him, the time tombs were opening.